Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone, and to our viewers from the Far East. Good night.
Welcome. Welcome to our 8th episode at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's, meaning Ben and myself, Svetlana. And actually, we decided to start this program not only to raise awareness and educate people on what is impact investing and how to get engaged in this sector, but to inspire with concrete actions from the existing projects, investors, companies, and moreover, we want to get into action, unconverted ones, by showing transformative journeys and of completely not sustainable companies which could take an action and incorporate impact in their business models, and now they generate positive social and environmental impact. And Ben, as you are an amazing storyteller, could you maybe share one of concrete examples of such a magical transformation supported by impact investing?
Oh, there are many, many going on around the world. I'll just give an example of my birth country in India. You know, last year, or basically it's still going on, is the COVID time. So last year, the first 3 months, the market nearly absolutely collapsed. So India saw nearly 50% more startups. They shut down because there was absolute freeze of their income, and also the funding declined by nearly 50%. But fast forward 3 months further, the second half, suddenly you see not only that the digital and the startup economy or the whole ecosystem grew extremely fast, it reached basically the level it was before the start of the pandemic. And for those who don't know, in last year, in 2020, when the whole world was suffering, India had 11 unicorns. So that's, I called it a kind of magical transformation.
Sounds good. Indeed. Any other example about that?
Another example I can mention is what happened in, I forgot the name of this person in India. He's a farmer who created complete barren land, who plants himself a tree each and every day, his whole life. I think he's doing it the last 30 plus years. And he has created such a massive forest that even now tigers and elephants and animals have moved in there. That is what I called a magical transformation. One man, just one man. He did it.
This is what I truly believe, that everyone can make an impact, you know, from one person or corporation, you can always make impact. And if we can share the slide now, I'd like also to share the next opportunity for everyone who'd like to learn about that. As after a few weeks back, we had a very successful start of our educational program and very positive feedback from our audience. So we want to invite all of you to our next free webinar, Profitable Business with Impact, which will take on the 1st March. So make a picture to have the link of this webinar. And if you missed it, you can also simply go to kamamal.ch to see events to join us. And maybe a few words about this workshop. So if you want to be a successful entrepreneur and grow your existing business or incorporate sustainability and impact, also learn about becoming a successful fundraiser to get the money for your project in this most booming and meaningful sector, impact investing, then it's definitely for you, because we will be teaching and you will learn how to create a successful and meaningful business at the same time, which is solving environmental and social issues while generating high returns. Also, we'll teach you and you will learn how to structure and scale your business to generate both high returns and impact, how to successfully fundraise and get the money from impact investors, how to get support and expertise, or maybe partnerships, because they amass massive funds available for impact businesses and as well resources. So I invite you all to join us on this impactful journey.
Thank you, Svetlana, for this introduction. I was just told that the person who I just told the story about of the forest, growing all a forest by himself, one man, his name is Jadhav Paying. And apparently he was also awarded by the President of India for this. So he's called the Forest Man. And now continuing to what Svetlana was saying, what I also do is help the companies structure and set up and also look into it, how they can put their time and energy and also make money by doing something good for the environment or for the nature. So on this, we are not only thinking about the carbon footprint, but we are also focusing on money and how we save, invest, or donate money to affect the climate. That's especially where my interest goes in the climate change.
And Martin is a speaker of today who actually represents asset owners who are large enough to finance all or most of sustainable development goals defined by United Nations all alone. And what he will talk about today is show us what are the insights. So we will learn how actually faiths invest their money and who are these relatively new but extremely asset-rich players in the field of impact investments. What is their intention and where do they invest? What are the areas of their investment and their investment criteria? So if you are a project owner or business owner who'd like to scale and you have high impact, then you might consider applying for funds with Faith Invest. And with this, I'd like to welcome Martin Palmer, the President and Interim Chief Executive Officer of Faith Invest, whom we were waiting since weeks, because a few weeks back he couldn't unfortunately. He's there! Welcome, Martin!
3 weeks late.
Weeks late, my colleagues will tell you, very happily, they will tell you, I am the worst person with ideas on the entire planet, and I can only apologize hugely. Total chaos. Your wonderful colleagues who were trying to advise me, I think they probably had to go and have a stiff drink and lie down afterwards. I certainly did. So I do apologize. Now, I gather from my colleagues who are watching going, where is he? Why isn't he on there? But you cover this really quite well.
And I was holding the stage for quite long last time. Like, okay, he's coming. Yeah. He's coming now. Maybe.
I am so sorry, and I've already promised Ben a couple of bottles of wine.
We have very high expectations with the audience for you now. So.
Anyway, can I just say, first of all, again, huge apologies for that complete mess up. But what a
delight
it is to be on this, and how, I mean, quite frankly, how impressive your setup is. I really am. I've known Ben for a while, so I'm not entirely surprised. But nevertheless, really,
I think. No, thank you, Martin, for joining us. It's our pleasure and our honor. So, and we waited 3 weeks for this. So he's a very, very old friend for the audience who don't know him. He's a very old friend of ours. And maybe, Martin, you will recognize this picture in Zug on 31st October 2017, when under your hawk eyes, That is the UNDP Manager of Nature and Development, Mrs. Jamison Irvin, presenting the sugar guideline to Cardinal Turkson from the Vatican. And you can see Reverend Palmer standing there looking very strict and serious. and may I say that this was sort of the birthplace of Faith Invest.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I'm not actually a reverend, Ben. I'm not a reverend. I am a lay preacher in the Church of England, but not ordained. But I am allowed to wear funny clothes and perform almost as good as being a clergyman. But I once considered becoming a priest, but then I realized I'd have to take a vow of obedience to a bishop, and I knew I'd break it within 24 hours.
So, what is Martin actually lay preacher?
Yeah. Sorry, what is? Well, because I'm a theologian, I studied theology, religious studies, and classical Chinese at Cambridge. Because I'm a theologian, I have a particular status. Also, I do an awful lot of stuff on the BBC about religion. So the Church of England, of which I'm a member, kind of thought, well, he's not one of our priests, so how do we kind of own him without trying to control him? So they created a sort of funny place for me, which is to be a lay preacher. It means that I do baptisms, I do funerals, I do services. And where the Church of England at the moment cannot go, to my regret, which is to bless or to perform marriage rituals for gay or lesbian couples, I do.
Ah, that's another beautiful side of you I was not aware of. Perfect. Well,
there we go. So, yeah, thank you for the question, Svetlana. It's an unusual, it's for those of us who are out there but are not formally part of the church, so that the church can say, oh, yes, we know what he's up to. Mm-hmm. But I suppose this is something to do with Faith Invest. It's to do with impact investing as well. There are those of us who are willing to be on the edge.
This is at the edge. They allow you to bless. Still, even though nobody else is doing.
Exactly. Well, let's just put it this way, Svetlana, try to stop me. And I think a lot of impact investing is those who are willing to go outside the comfort zone of their own organizations, go outside the comfort zone of conventional economics, conventional sustainability, indeed, conventional environment, and say, there are new boundaries, there are new areas, there are new partnerships that we need to strike, and they don't fit within the normal structure of what is significant. I mean, Ben, you've chronicled many times the growth of impact investing, indeed of ESG investing and so on. And there's always been a period where the powers that be have gone, it's a fad. There's no return here. There's no profit. Why would you do this? Only to be proved wrong.
Yep.
Right.
Need people out there on the edge, cutting the edge.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we understand that because we are also at the age, you know. Especially, 5 years ago, when I was talking about impact investing in the bank, it was really at the age. People were laughing at me, like, "Yeah, you with your impact investing, ha ha ha." But the time changed. And now they are also more interested in that and actually want to get engaged. So you're just being patient and the times change. Let me ask you the first question because it's quite related to what you're just talking about. So you are fairly new to the impact investing world, right? So you spent 4 decades working with faith groups on environmental issues. For much of that time was a Secretary General of the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, known as ARC. And since 2009, you've been the founding president and interim CEO of Faith Invest, which grew out of ARC and is a new global nonprofit organization that works to grow the scale and impact of faith-consistent investing. So how did this come about and why was it a natural step for you going to this age?
That's a very good question. You're quite right. For 40 years, I've been working on the theme of religion and environment. And for 36 of those years, I've been the religious advisor on the environment to His Royal Highness Prince Philip. And as you all know, he is in hospital at the moment. I would ask you to hold him in your thoughts and prayers. It will be 100 in June. And it was his invitation to me. I was running a multi-faith education center in inner city Manchester in the UK, working with schools on religious education and really beginning to move us beyond just teaching about Christianity, talking about all the major faiths. And I was asked to create a book for the British education system on the role of religions and environment. It was the first actual book ever produced on the multi-faith religious approach. And Prince Philip read this. He was then the international president of WWF, and he asked me to organize the 25th anniversary of WWF in 1986 in Assisi, bringing Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, and Jewish leaders together with all the major members of the environmental movements around the world. And we did, and it was hugely successful. And from that has grown what the UN described in 2009 as the largest civil society movement on the environment, the religions. There are millions of faith-based projects around the world. And I've been very excited about that. That was what ARC was set up to do, was to take that the next step forward, still with His Royal Highness Prince Philip as our great patron and inspiration. However, during that period, 1997 and then again in 2007, I was asked to create a Atlas of Religion. Mm-hmm. This was to map, you know, first of all, the stuff that everybody wants to know, you know, how many Muslims are there in X country and how many Hindus and how many Jews and all the rest of it. So it was a mapping of where the religious spread was, what countries were predominantly Christian or Buddhist or what have you. But we also looked at things like where they controlled schools, where they were in relationship with political systems or political parties, where they were official religions licensed by the country. Then we looked at things like gender, we looked at finance, investment, media, and so on. And in doing that and having a small team of researchers who worked on that for me, what I came to realize by around about 2000 was that the faiths honestly had no idea how much they controlled. They had no idea. They had outhoused all their finances to financial managers. So the fund managers themselves, the faith fund managers themselves, had kind of lost track. As long as the money came in, they weren't too worried. They, in many cases, particularly in developing countries, they had no idea how many schools they had or how many clinics they had. They didn't know how much land they owned. It was extraordinary. So we began a process of asking the faiths to audit what they owned. Mm-hmm. The results were quite staggering. We discovered that the faiths are amongst the largest stakeholders on the planet. So I'll just give you some figures quickly.
Give us figures. Yes, give us figures.
Oh, I know all you finance people. I mean,
impress the bankers, impress the managers.
All right, I'll give you some figures, but remember, we're a narrative species. We tell stories. Yep. When we want something really important, we tell stories. But anyway, data, Svetlana.
I like the stories, by the way.
I also like the stories, but we need data, so I need to be the bad one here.
All right, Svetlana, you be the bad one. Schools, 50% of all schools around the world are still managed, run, or have a major involvement with faith. And according to UNICEF, in a later survey we did with them, 64% of all schools in sub-Saharan Africa are faith-based. A third of all universities and colleges of higher education are faith-based. Mm-hmm. More than a third of all medical facilities, probably somewhere around about 35 to 40% of all hospitals and clinics mm-hmm. are run by the faiths. They are mm-hmm. the third largest investing group in the world. The point you made right at the beginning, Svetlana, that if we shift the faith, we shift the market. They own about 8% of the habitable surface outright. Another 15% of the surface of the planet is considered sacred, sacred mountains, sacred rivers, sacred lakes. Not necessarily owned by the faiths, but protected because they're sacred. There's a kind of penumbra of holiness. And just another figure, 5% of all commercial forests are faith-owned. Mm-hmm. So really what we discovered was the end of the 90s and into the noughties, was the degree to which the faiths are stakeholders in the planet. But they were behaving as though all they could do was preach. And we were saying, it's lovely if you want to preach, although not all faiths do. The Shinto don't preach, which is lovely. You can go to a Shinto service and not be preached at. It's great. I recommend it. But more important than their preaching was that they actually did what they said should happen. There's a wonderful Confucianist quote. And Confucius said, first of all, practice what you want to preach about. Mm-hmm. And then preach about what you're already practicing. And in a sense, I would say that for the last two decades, my work has been focused on getting the faiths to put their own houses in order that they can then say to national governments, to the multinationals, to the UN, the World Bank, we can do that, why don't you? Or doing it, you're doing it, why don't we join together? So really the Faith Invest has come out of, in fact, we first started working on faiths and investment back in 2001. And this came about, I'll tell you the story because it's Ben likes stories.
Yeah. Everyone likes stories, so please go ahead.
So, I was invited to go in about 2000. I was invited to go for a meeting with the United Methodist Church of the United States. Now they have about 9 million members. They're small in comparison with the Catholics at 65 million, and the Southern Baptists about 35 million. But they are a good old historic church and tradition. And so I was invited to go to Nashville, their headquarters, and to hear what they were doing on the environment. And it was very much what I expected. They're a very engaged, socially engaged community. The Methodists emerged from the Anglican Church at the end of the 18th century, very much as a working class church, a church dealing with issues of self-respect, teaching people to be able to read, have pride in who they were because they were loved by God. And so very strong social message. Anyway, they went round the table and, you know, we were hearing what the youth department was doing on environment. We heard what the properties department was doing on greening their buildings. We heard about the theological training. They were introducing theological teachings about the environment. The women's group, immensely formidable crowd, they were doing some incredible work. So they had managed, they'd identified that the Methodist Church in the United States was using more paper than the whole of Sweden. I mean, just one of those figures where you think, wow. Anyway, so they decided, that the Methodist women decided that this was appalling. They needed to address this. So they wrote to all their branches and they said, we want you to go to the local supplier, your local supplier of the paper you use for producing your weekly notices, your parish magazines. And we want you to ask for FSC, Forest Stewardship Council, paper, the most ecological paper. So they went on one Saturday. They all went to their local branches. And all these stationery companies said, oh, there's no demand. They said, but we're a demand. They said, yes, but nobody else is interested. So they withdrew. They did not go to any of those companies. Within a month, every single one of those companies had brought in 5 to 10 different choices of environmental paper. That's how strong Methodist.
This is exactly what needs to be done, you know, and a lot. It's a lot on the market.
So we're sitting there. Then we come to the pensions fund, and so the pensions person in charge of the pensions fund of the Methodists said, "Yes, we just made a decision, and this is 2000." To shift 10% of our disposable income into environmental and sustainable investment projects. Well, I went, oh, wow, that's really good. And I said, and, you know, how much have you got in your pension fund? And she said, well, currently $13 billion. And I kind of went, how much? $13 billion. Then I asked a question. Now, the Methodists are called Methodists because they're methodical. And I said, if that's what you've got in your pension fund, how much money do you have invested as an entire church? Deadly silence. They said, come back in 6 months. I came back in 6 months. They said, we didn't know. We do now. $71 billion. that was the point at which I realized that there was a hidden treasure, literally, within the faith that nobody was accessing, therefore nobody was accessing, that the faith themselves were not realizing how potentially powerful they were, if not combining, but if they were working side by side. Right. And then, so that led us to go to the faiths in 2001 to 2004 with a series of consultations, thinking that they already had negative screening. But what really shocked me was that I would say that by the, around about 2001, 2002, less than 20% of religious funds had a negative screening program.
So we otherwise, they were all investing in weapons and alcohol, tobacco, and so on, gambling. Yay!
Absolutely. There were the historical bans. So there was the historical ban of usury in Islam. There was the historical ban with the Quakers, the Society of Friends, nothing to do with the military. There were many of them that had a ban on alcohol. A few were just beginning to ban tobacco. But really, there was nothing there. So he encouraged people to think about, well, you know, why don't you work out what you get? And then really what happened was that in 2015, the UN asked my then organization, the Alliance of Religions Conservation, and we had the largest network of faith groups in the world working on the environment, about 700 different religious organizations. And they said, could you bring them together with main sections of the UN to look at the SDGs, because believe it or not, the UN had forgotten to consult with the faiths about the SDGs.
I can't believe, you know, because I also had a pleasure to talk, I will not name the department, with some very high level UN guys, and they themselves don't invest based on SDGs. No. The ones which they created, you know. So how can that be? So if you are UN, you created SDGs, they have plenty of assets, and even they don't do that. So of course, I can believe what you said.
I can believe that. However, what then transpired was that the various faiths made statements about the elements of the SDGs they would support. And we got a call, and so it was 2015, the SDGs were agreed in late September. Middle of November, we get a phone call from the UN, from UNDP, saying, and we've just looked through these papers from your event. We noticed that nine of the very big organizations, like the Jesuits, for example, have said they're thinking of moving their investments into environmental and sustainable investment. We don't just talk about sustainable development. Most sustainable development has no environmental significance for other species at all. Basically, they plant a tree at the end and they think that's the environment bit. So so we always made the point it's environmental and sustainable development. And literally, this person at the other end of the phone said, do the faiths have any money? So we said, yeah, they are the third largest investing group in the world. And you could almost hear this person at the other end kind of, you know, gasping with shock. They said, we eventually got commissioned by UNDP and OECD to produce a white paper on faiths and finance, which is on the Faith Invest website. And we were able to show, even though we were only able to sort of look at about 65 different religious faith investment groups, and there are hundreds, we were able to show the scale. And what then happened, and we launched that in China at a big UN event in 2016. And then the UN said, look, could you possibly bring the faith together to discuss investing in the SDGs and so on and so forth? And so we held a conference, which Ben remembers, at Zug in 2017, at which we brought the major groups together along with the UN and various other groups. And it was decided there that the faiths wanted to have their own body, their own organization that would enable them to make the shift. And our very first success was that the following weekend, one of the largest Catholic family funds in the world, who had sent their head of investments and their head of philanthropy to the meeting, had a meeting, and they said, we must break the Chinese wall between where we invest and what we do with the money. And that's 30 billion. They have now set, I think it's a 15-year program, and they're now 5 years into it. to make that shift. And what we've seen since then, Svetlana, is has been quite extraordinary, because suddenly the world has woken up to the fact that the only group of investors in the world that actually have values that you can point to and say, how could you possibly do that given what you believe, faiths.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is great news, you know, Martin, because it's so easy to convince you to transform the money because you have the belief already. So you just need to act. And I just wanted to underline that this shift, which you were talking about, happened at Swiss Impact Investment Association, where Ben is the president and I am in the board. So just to say to everyone, Swiss Impact Investment Association acts and shifts and unites everyone for acting on SDGs.
I think we made a big mistake. We should have created a 4 hours program. Because if I listen to Martin, I'm completely lost. His stories are so amazing. I think we'll never get through our questions, not even 5% of it.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I think it's very, very interesting.
One last thing, Svetlana.
And as he missed our show last time, we can say, okay, you come again this year, Martin.
I owe you. And Ben is going to get his pound of flesh. I know.
Yeah, exactly.
Svetlana, one of the really important things is that we did was that none of the groups who come to the meeting in Zug, which did, you're absolutely right, took place because we had an invitation from SIA, Swiss Impact Investing Association, to partner with them. And then we tied in with this wonderful Jesuit center in Zug, which is the Jesuit International Center on Christianity and Entrepreneurship. I mean, it's a stop, and it's so beautiful, such a beautiful place. But we said to all the groups that we invited to come to this meeting in Zug with SIA.
Mm-hmm. Martin, but what happened since then? How many of these 30 trillions were now invested after 4 years now?
Martin, I had already warned you about Svetlana, remember?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I see exactly what you mean, Ben. My goodness me. Anyway. Just very quickly, what we asked each of those groups that came to do was really quite outrageous. We said, you can only come if you will produce a set of guidelines, which we call the Zug guidelines. They're on the Faith Press website. And to do that, each faith had to go back to its core beliefs. What are they? What do you believe? Why are we here? Why is the rest of life on earth here? What is the meaning of all this? From that, what are the core values that come out of those beliefs? Given those core values, what won't you invest in? But given those core values, what will you invest in? Nobody had ever asked the faiths to go from telling you what you couldn't do to saying what you could do. Yeah. Religions love telling you what you mustn't do. Said, we know what you're against. What are you for?
And this is more difficult, Martin. You know, even if you ask a normal person, what do you want? Or it's more difficult to answer than what I don't want, right? Well, it's much more difficult to answer, what do you want? What do you
How much has moved? Since then, you're working with religions. Now, the great thing about religions is that they are the most sustainable organizations in the world. We have outlived empires, including the British Empire, but we'll
a little bit of a mistake. Will you outlive climate change?
Yes, we will. We've outlived the Black Death. We've outlived the League of Nations. We've outlived fascism. We've largely outlived communism. I give it another 20 years. Mm-hmm. We've outlived empires and dynasties. You know, we'll be there. We'll be there because then what we address is why we're here, not. And that is an eternal question. I mean, if you look at any of the great faiths, their great skill, Svetlana, is that they're here to be unchanging because they change at a pace that people can manage. Mm-hmm. I've been in the environmental movement for 40 years. I cannot tell you how many campaigns I've been told we're going to save the planet. You know, we got 3 years to save the oceans. We got 2 years to save this. We got 5 years to save that. We're now into this fiction that by 2030, if we don't save the world, it'll all collapse apart. Well, in my world of religions, we've been predicting the end of the world probably since time in the Vedas, I think, then, years ago. And it ain't happened yet, because actually setting dates for something actually doesn't encourage people, paralyzes them. And that's why I think the investing world is so important in this. Faiths invest, the average length of a faith investment is 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thinking we need, not we've only got 9 years left. Because if you only plan for 9 years and you get to January the 1st, 2031, what the hell are you going to do?
Absolutely, I completely agree. And I mean, impact investments, the true impact investments with high impact, you must have this patient capital, which is there in order to create in-depth impact, to transform and create maybe little return, you know, for investors. So this this approach, what you just said, it's just completely perfect for and impact investors.
It works too, because one of the other great things is that the faiths understand human psychology. And there's a wonderful phrase. I've worked mostly with the conservation movement for 40 years. And I love them. I love them. They are a pretty miserable bunch. everything is going down the pan. You've got to give up everything. You can't do this. You can't eat that. You can't buy that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I've often said to them, you know, yeah, of course, of course. You know, in the religions, we know how to help people fast, how to live more simply. So we're in the middle of Lent in Christianity, where we give up things, we reflect on the material world and the spiritual world, where we'll be going into Ramadan shortly. All the faiths have a period of deep reflection. In Judaism, you have the great festivals. But then we party. And we celebrate and we go, wow, isn't this a great place? And there's a wonderful Jewish statement which I love throwing into this whole rather earnest, you know, you mustn't do this, you mustn't do that, you can't, you've got to give this up. This Jewish statement which says, if, when on the day of judgment, when you're brought before God, you will be judged and condemned for every legitimate pleasure that you could have had. And do not think.
Well, I have already an idea for the next show. You know, we should make a party with Faith Invest, right? To surprise the folks and show them.
Ben's been to our party. We held a big party with banners and music and drama and processions. But I think what the faiths are very good at is that, you know, we've lasted this long because we tell stories. I mean, I'm a theologian, Svetlana. So when you talk to me about data, as a theologian, I have to recognize that for 2,000 years, Christianity has tried to work out how to get three into one and one into three, and we still haven't sorted it out. And that's about as close as we get to data. We are storytellers. We are a narrative species. And the great stories of the great religions, and not just the great religions, but the great cultures, like the great stories from Greece or from things like the Ramayana and so forth, these are profound stories about what it is to be human, what it is to deal with struggle and conflict and dissent and to build new models, new patterns, new pictures out of it. Therefore, if you want to build long-term, it's wonderfully put and summarized by Gunilla Hahn, who is the head of investments for the Church of Sweden. Church of Sweden has, I think it's 10 billion krona. And she says, we invest for eternity. That's what that place can do.
Now, I like that. Invest for eternity.
Invest for eternity. And if you're not investing for eternity, if you're not thinking, how could this still be happening 500 years hence?
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of missing the point. It's not about personal wealth. It's not about personal aggrandizement. Money in all the faiths is simply energy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the views of the faiths, the ban on usury is that, and the Taoists in China have a ban on usury. The whole emphasis of the ban on usury is it's as though Ben had managed to get 1,000 huge batteries filled with energy, and he puts them in the basement of his house. in case one day his torch doesn't work. Rather than saying, I have got enough energy here to power an entire village in India or an entire college of higher education in Bhutan, or, you know, in other words, it's not ours. It's not ours. It's energy that should be put to the use. And Islam teaches that. That's why there's no usury. Absolutely, you can make a profit if you will take the risk with the people who are taking the risk. But if you don't take the risk and you just want to make sure you secure your money, you are like Ben with his batteries in the basement saying, yeah, I'm okay. You can have a little bit of power, but you pay me for it, rather than, I've got all this power, why aren't I using it to make something happen?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Now let's get to more serious parts. So what do you find yourself the biggest challenge to faith, adopting more faith-consisting investing?
Fund managers. one of the things that's been most surprising to all of us in Faith Invest, as we've started working with, we're heading up towards about 100 members at the moment. So a lot of groups working on their guidelines at the moment. The most extraordinary thing is how small the financial staff are in most faith investment groups. And they're often managing, billions of dollars or pounds. But they're very small. Why? Because basically over the last 60, 70 years, the faith has outhoused the management of the money to fund managers. And therefore, all they've really got are some accounting staff inside who work out how much is coming in and where it goes, and keep a track on it. But our biggest issue, and we're in fact about to start a major program, really beginning to produce an index of the fund managers who can manage to relate. We have a phrase, Svetlana, that Ben knows, called faith consistent investing.
Mm-hmm.
That's consistent in terms of what you don't invest in and consistent in what term of what you do invest in. So at the head of our membership team, the wonderful Nana Francois, is with her team, is developing an index of fund managers who have enough imagination, enough understanding of why we need to put our money to good use. They would actually be a group you could take your assets to. But also, I would say, we're seeing the face going, well, hang on a minute, why are we paying huge fees to external managers who aren't doing what we want, aren't consistent with our beliefs? Why don't we bring in a house, buy some proper stock, set up our own department, work out it is we want to do with the money. So the biggest problem, fund managers. They're not imaginative.
I agree.
Martin, how would you explain the difference between responsible investing, faith-consistent investing, impact investing? So how is it different? Could you please elaborate on that?
That's a very good question. It's a very good question. With all due respect to your title, I think impact is in danger of losing any real significant meaning. Any investment has an impact. I mean, if you invest in zinc and they go and bulldoze a forest in Malaysia, that's an impact. So what is the criteria for what is a good impact or a bad impact? It's not just a criteria, it's an impact. And I think we found it very difficult coming into this market. I mean, obviously, you've got groups like Gin who are doing, really amazing stuff in terms of, the fund management world. And they are breaking through, I think, in certain ways. But we decided to create a title that, in a sense, reflected the uniqueness of the faiths because we have values.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was very funny. When we did Zug with Sia back in 2017, all the faiths had to come saying what their beliefs and values were. And we were well into this, and we were getting fantastic stuff back from them. And we had nine commercial sponsors, banks, investment companies. And so suddenly one of our development committee members said, well, why don't we ask them to tell us what their values are?
Mm-hmm.
It was pathetic. I mean, I'm not joking. It was profoundly, shockingly pathetic. I had to keep sending it back, going, I'm sorry. Answering the phone within 15 seconds of it ringing is not value. Seriously, one group, that was the only value they had. The most common response was, we don't have any values. We only have the values of our customers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a load of absolute nonsense. That's just an abnegation of values. Yeah. That basically means you're a whore on sale for the price. That's all it is. That's not values. That's not values. So part of this is that it has to be faith-consistent investing, mm-hmm. because that's the criteria. If this mm-hmm. is not consistent with your faith, then you should not mm-hmm. be doing it. And if it is consistent with your faith, then you should do it. There's a very interesting movement, Svetlana, within Islam. Now, as we all know, the Sharia law tells mm-hmm. what you cannot invest in, what is haram, forbidden, and not allowed. And the growth of Islamic banking since the first truly modern Islamic non-usury bank appeared, the Dubai Islamic Bank in 1973, has been phenomenal. Phenomenal. I mean, it's hundreds of billions of dollars. But it's always been what they were against. There is now this fascinating movement, which we are part of, led by the Muslim Union of Indonesia, the largest Muslim organization in the world, 42 million members, 800,000 mosques, 80,000 schools, 17 banks and insurance companies, all run by the Muslim Union. They are now saying, well, Sharia tells us what we cannot invest in. Therefore, if it is not forbidden, surely we can invest in it. And so they are developing a proactive Sharia investment code. Now, that can only happen because there is a fundamental, God-given, divinely revealed Quran, supplemented by the stories of the Prophet, the Hadith, codified from the 9th century onwards into the Sharia law, by which you can work out what it is to be faithful to Islam and therefore invest.
Mm-hmm.
No other group other than the faiths have those foundations. So we do talk about faith consistent investing. We engage with the impact investing world. We engage with the ESG world. We engage with the SDGs. And I think for many, many people that we know in the financial world, the SDGs is simply another way of talking about ESG for the next 9 years. It's not actually more than that. It's also for us a big problem, the SDGs, because it's really a manual on how to keep consumerist capitalism going. Whereas our faiths have profound questions about the very nature of finance. It's rather like, I think the SDGs are rather like buying a table from IKEA in order that you get the manual telling you how to construct it, not because you want to entertain family and friends around it for the next 50 years, but you want mm-hmm. a place where you dine with friends, a place where you cry together, a place where you celebrate birthdays and mm-hmm. anniversaries, and where you host with hospitality. That's why many of the faiths have a problem with the SDGs. They're a manual for construction, not a manual for living. And I think mm-hmm. that's quite important. So we relate to all those, but the faiths kind of look at them and go, yeah, yeah, we've been here before, sort of things. You know, we mm-hmm. were there with the Medicis, and we were there with the Chinese Empire and trade in China and all of that. Really, what we're talking about is what is it is that is distinctive? Why is it that the faiths have something that nobody else has? You can go to the religious teachings and you can say, why are you doing that? You can also say, why aren't you doing that? Name me one other group that you can do that with.
Yeah.
But may I just ask one more question here, because it's really on my tongue. It's like, because it's not for me, it's for all the projects which are watching us, you know, or company owners which are looking for funds. You know, nowadays everyone is looking for funds, and ideally they want it yesterday, not even tomorrow, but yesterday. So everyone is looking for funds. How can they get the funds from Faith Invest? How can they apply? What are the investment criteria? Where to apply? How long does it take? What is the process? Maybe you can give an example. Like, I'm sorry, Martin,
I see,
but
Martin's
really...
face is getting redder and redder.
Let me first of all say, Faith Invest does not manage money. all the money remains within the domain and under the control of each of the different faith groups. Nor are mm-hmm. we, I'll come to that slightly later, nor are we necessarily thinking about any structure that would collate this money. But I will come to that later with the idea of religious development banks. But essentially, amongst our hundreds of groups that we're in touch with, almost 1,000 groups will be probably in our network by September. They retain control over the money. What they join us for, what they are involved with things like the faith long-term plans, which we're doing with the UN, is that they are setting their own criteria for what they do. What mm-hmm. we are doing is, first of all, a collective sense that they're not alone in doing this. Mm-hmm. Secondly, support and ideas. So, for example, we are in discussion with the World Bank Climate Investment Fund for them to, because one of the big problems is with so few staff, they cannot do the due diligence that is necessary if you're going to invest. So we are setting up a series of pipelines of potentially investable projects. And with partner bodies like the World Bank, like the UN, various other instruments around the world, we are helping to provide the due diligence.
So you are doing the due diligence. That's amazing. You know, the preachers doing due diligence on investment projects.
We are helping them. But we're bringing specialisms like CIF. I mean, CIF does amazing due diligence on climate mm-hmm. investment funds programs. Yeah. But that's not been accessible to the private sector. Now, because of the faiths, the World Bank is considering opening up that to the private sector. But what I'm saying is this. If you have groups out there with projects that can, that they feel have got the ability to reach, to undergo due diligence, to be surveyed, we are creating a platform for our faith investors to see those projects. Mm-hmm. At this stage, the platform goes live, I think now at the beginning of June. Bear in mind, it only came into existence in September 2019. We spent most of last year sitting in our bedrooms, so it's been a struggle. But yes, we are creating, we know that the major problem for the religions, as we encourage, we've got at the moment, Svetlana, about $1.5 trillion worth of religious investment that wants to make that shift. Mm-hmm. Over, not tomorrow, certainly not by yesterday, over time, because this has got to support hospitals, it's got to support schools, it's got to support mm-hmm. orphanages, it's got to support old people's homes, it's got to support HIV/AIDS programs. You know, this is not just for personal profit. This is to keep communities together. That's what faiths do. So we've only been going for a while, but what we are saying is one of the problems is the faiths don't have the ability to do due diligence because they don't have the staff. So we're providing networks of due diligence, like the World Bank and others, and they don't have the time to go out and find these projects, but they don't have enough projects yet to meet the amount of money they want to shift. So our role is to help find pipelines of investable projects around the world, which meet the core criteria, which is that, and it's very much based on the Pope's teaching in Laudato Si, his great encyclical of 2015, it must be for people and planet. Mm-hmm. And rudimentary. If this in any way is, and it must be socially just, you must pay proper wages, there must be a proper chain of delivery surveillance, I'm getting quite the right word is. But yes, we are interested, and in many cases, we are dealing already with small to medium scale projects around the world, which no investor would normally invest in because they come in at $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million. We are going to put those into baskets. So for example, we're working with a wonderful group called the Interfaith Rainforest Initiative, which is working in Peru, Brazil, Colombia, the Congo, and Indonesia. And with them, we're looking at how because if you want to protect a forest, you protect the local people. But if the local people are only seen as kind of nature wardens, then what are they going to live on? So our role is essentially to put money into into enabling them to have a livable lifestyle, a livable income from the forest, but a sustainable one. So they're joining us, and they will be creating a pipeline of investable projects over the next couple of years. Now, most of those will be small scale. We bundle them together. We put them into a package of, say, 10 million to 20 million. And then we get a bundle of faith investors who will put the funding in. The one thing that is beginning to emerge, and I was not expecting this, is the notion of faith development banks. Mm-hmm. In other words, the faith saying, why don't we actually collectively, as Catholics or as Hindus or as Jews, why don't we collectively, under our faith title, have some kind of central structure that enables us to be proactive alongside the Africa Development Bank? Obviously, there is already the Islamic Development Bank, but that is a national, that's national groups. We're being approached by many Muslim groups saying, look, they may be Islamic nations, but we want a Muslim development bank, which will fund any faith at all. So there are all sorts of things growing, but the heart of this is that it is faith consistent. It is the fact that you can say, you say in your faith teachings, you say in your values, this is what is important. Why aren't you doing X, Y, and Z? And obviously, impact investing is big. We've just helped Jin produce their survey on faiths and investment. You know, it's terribly exciting, Svetlana.
I know. I have so much questions, but now I need to give the word to Ben. Otherwise, I will have problem after the show, I think.
I know what a tyrant that man is. So, Ben, over to you, mate.
No, but just thinking, because you just mentioned about values. You know, at this moment, we are going through a pandemic. But if you even look inside the pandemic, in the world's 1% of the richest people have last year gained more than $3.9 trillion, while the poorest people have lost more than $3.7 trillion. And the women and the young people generally, especially if you look at Africa and all that, they are bearing the brunt. So don't you think that the faiths, having so many millennials of experience, have a role to play in advising the rich?
That's a very, very good question indeed. I mean, I sit on the Pope's COVID commission. I think there's one Lutheran and I'm the only other non-Catholic. But we've been hearing for the last 9 months of the impact of this on poor communities, and not just on poor communities, but on, you know, low and middle class communities. And it's a devastating. It is a complete wipeout, quite apart from the educational issues, particularly for girls, because it's hard enough to get girls into school at the best of times. We've been running through another group that I chair, Faith in Water. We've been running a big program in Uganda for the last 3 years on menstruation, on making sure that it is possible for girls when they're menstruating to go to school, because there are the facilities, there are recognition of it. It's been remarkably successful in that sense, hugely successful. But break that link with school, and you really do run the risk that the girls don't go back. Because if you're prioritizing the use of money, unfortunately, that tends to mean you prioritize the boys. So the impact is huge. On that, we are also looking at working with the fact that the faiths have built the infrastructure on the ground of large sections, as I mentioned, of education and health. And we are now looking at a program to get the faiths to reinvest into the infrastructure that they built sometimes, you know, 200, 300 years ago, because of their role in local communities. So we are going to be looking at how can the hospitals and the schools be reconsidered and reconceived as something you invest in with a modest return, but the biggest return is actually leveling up. Your question about wealth, there is a phrase in the Bible, Svetlana, which you may know, in which a rich young man comes to Jesus and says, you know, I've obeyed all the laws, Jewish laws, I've done all the rituals, what more can I do to enter the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus says to the rich young man, give everything away. And he goes, and Jesus says, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, you also have the wonderful teaching of Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikhs. Guru Nanak's living round about the end of the 15th century in India. And he's at a great banquet, and the merchant who is giving this great banquet says, look how blessed I am by God. Thank you, Guru. So blessed. May I give you this gold plate, you know, to take home? And Guru Nanak looks at this gold plate and he goes, yeah, okay, no, that's fine. May I give you this pin? And he gives him a tiny little pin. He says, may I give you this pin? And the merchant's a little bit confused by this. So the merchant says, yes, of course, Guru. What do you want me to do with it? I said, I want you to look after that, says the Guru. Of course. And would you give it back to me in heaven? And the merchant goes, I can't possibly. Oh, right. In other words, we're not taking anything out of this world other than our souls. However, Svetlana, the great problem with that is that as the church became wealthier after the persecution of the church in the first three centuries in the West under the Romans, when it became established and became wealthy, that was a really, really difficult teaching. Mm-hmm. So somebody came up with the idea that there was a gate, a small gate, in the wall of Jerusalem that was called the Eye of the Needle, and you could just get a camel through it. They're completely undermining the whole point that Jesus was making. We're not taking any of this with us.
I think, you know, I just had the most inspiring preach in my life.
That's Martin Farmer.
Exactly. No, and I completely agree with you, and I know that, you know, I'm a yogi as well, so I know that completely we don't take anything with us. But for those who are not yet so conscious, impact investing, it's not just philanthropy. You get at least your money back, right? And maybe also a certain type of return, up to market return, right? Just not to scare people with impact investing.
I think one of the great things about the faiths is to say, to what purpose is this money? Now, I mean, there is a problem. There is a serious problem, because what has grown up in, I would say, actually, probably in the last 100 years, within all the faiths, is what's called the gospel of prosperity. And this is the belief that it's expressed. Well, I'll take it in Buddhism. There are particular forms of contemporary Buddhism that say, if you meditate on making money, then you will be better able to make money. Anything that more betrayed the teachings of the Buddha, it is hard to imagine. But you also have, particularly in some parts of America and Latin America, sub-Saharan Africa, a form of Christianity which says, if you're a true Christian and you give lots of money to the church, you will get lots of money back and you'll be able to have a big car and a better job and all the rest of it. So there has always been this tension between those who see wealth as a blessing from God, or the divine, or the Buddha, or whatever, and those who basically say, no, that's not the point of wealth. And it's an ancient struggle. And I mean, some cultures are blunt about it. I'm a China specialist, you know. And in China, the three most popular deities, particularly New Year, which we just had, are the god of wealth, the god of officialdom, of posts, of career, and the god of long life. And the Chinese are quite blunt about this. You know, this is to be comfortable, you need to have a good income, you have to have a good job, and you have to live long enough that, you know, you're remembered, your children pray for you, and all the rest of it. We helped develop at a place called Lo Guan Dai, which is where, for those of you who know your Chinese culture, it's where the great teacher Lao Tzu, the old master, wrote down the greatest book in Chinese religion, which is the Tao Te Ching, the teaching of the way and the power. And this is a big pilgrimage center, and we helped that become, through investment by Taoists, lay Taoists, become the largest environmental pilgrimage city anywhere in China. It's stunning. Mm-hmm. My delight, and part of this was they built a new temple complex down towards the river. And when I went to visit this to see how they were doing, there was a sign, and I read classical Chinese, sign of a side road off to this new shrine. And it said in Chinese, Temple of the God of Wealth, which in Chinese is absolutely standard. You know, you cannot care for your family if you do not have the means to care for your family. Or, and a family in China meant, you know, 300 relatives in the same village. In English, the title in English was Temple of Mammon. Mm-hmm. Now, that sort of tension in Christianity between serving God or serving Mammon has meant we've had a sort of schizoid relationship in Christianity, which is, after all, the largest faith in the world and the largest investing faith in the world. We've had this schizoid that somehow Mammon was bad, and if you go to the side of Mammon, of greed, of money, and so forth, you know, you're almost kind of beyond the pale. And we joke in Faith Invest. We are wonderful Nana and Mike Evan who and Matt Jensen, who run our membership. These are our finance advisory people. We say they've all come from the dark side. You know, we've saved them basically from their baker hell. But that's a joke for us. But there is that schizoid element that somehow there is the world of philanthropy and faith, and that's nice. And then there's the world of business. And that division, which if you go back to Adam Smith, he was a moral philosopher. But the ties between morality and wealth separated, and we allowed them to separate. And we've got to put them back together again. So almost we need morally consistent investing, not mm-hmm. just a good return. And I, the struggle is huge, Svetlana. But the faith have, I think, largely failed in being able to address the wealthy. And the figures that Ben has just cited are scandalous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Growing that way for the last 40, 50 years, who really has spoken out against that? About mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are struggling with that as much as anybody else.
And so what are the challenges then? You know, how can we help, or how can a financial sector help to faith invest and to all the religious to enable the shift of capital and to invest? Because there are a lot of people in banks, you know, which are frustrated, which are looking for meaning. I think we need to find kind of collaboration between capitalism and faith that we could work together on this.
You're absolutely right. And thank you, because I hadn't thought of this. But yeah, let me just simply say, we need more independent fund managers and fund manager groups. We've worked with the wonderful group Responsibility down mm-hmm. there in Europe. Great crowd, fantastic work they're doing. We need 100 of those, 1,000 of those. So if you're in a boring job making money for some oligarch who doesn't even know how to spend this money, break free. Break mm-hmm. free. Actually, yep. Go to your own core values. Look in your own heart. Is this what you want to be? Do you want to be a serf? Do you want to be a slave to somebody else's economic model? Break free. Set up with others, an ethical or even a faith-based investment group, mm-hmm. Investment management group, and come to us, because we need more people like that. Break free, because also, for God's sake, take a salary cut. I'm quite serious. When we decided we needed to create Faith Invest, we set up a development group, and on the development group, we have people from the banking, the finance, the UN, World Bank. We have people from the faith. We have people from the charity world. When it came to deciding we were going to set up Faith Invest, the question came up of what do we pay the CEO? Now, this split the group down the middle. So from the charity world, they said 80 to 100,000 pounds. And the people from the finance world went, "You won't even get a cleaner for that." And in the end, we had to agree that we would pay, although since I became the interim CEO, I've cut the salary, because I think it's mm-hmm. We agreed that it should be set at the salary of the Prime Minister of Great Britain, which is £160,000.
Mm-hmm.
We have found it a real struggle to find anybody from the finance world who will work for that.
That's crazy, right? It's a lot of money, you know, just different life standards, and then people are not...
I'll put it in perspective. One of my dearest friends who advised us a great deal on this, setting up Faith Invest, very, very successful fund manager, made a great deal of money, now works, supports us free of charge, is invaluable to the whole process. I've known him for 20 years. And he has asked me for the last 18 years, "Come on, Martin, come and work for me and you'll be a millionaire within 2 years." And I'm going, "I don't want to be a millionaire. That's not why I'm here." Okay. And then he would say, "Come on, how much do they pay? What is the charity for you? Because, you know, what are they going to pay? I'm sure we can offer you more." So eventually I cracked, Svetlana, I cracked. And I said, "All right, I'll tell you how much I get." So I said, "I get £80,000. He went, "Oh, that's not bad per month." I went...
What was he thinking about, that you are on 20,000 or what?
Who knows? I mean, I just don't know what his mind... But that mindset that I'm worth it...
Mm-hmm.
No, nobody is worth the money that is being paid at the top of the banks and the investment world. Nobody. And that money is stolen from the poor.
Yeah. It's didn't you have a fight at home?
Sorry?
Didn't you have a fight at home after this?
With my wife? No.
Yeah.
I'm paid too much now as it is. you know, 80,000 is what I've normally been on. When I was appointed the interim CEO, because the COVID struck, and we couldn't recruit, I cut the salary from 160 to 130, and I still consider myself to be incredibly well paid, incredibly well paid. And I think you said earlier, Svetlana, that you know, you were talking about the UN not actually applying its own values to investing. Well, I would ask anybody who claims to be an impact investor, take a long, hard look at how much you're paid.
Mm-hmm.
Probably cut it by a half to start with, and put that half into a philanthropic fund that would enable groups to begin to develop business plans that could be investable.
Yeah, I think we are talking here about consciousness shift as well. You know, for me, it's always about consciousness shift at the end. You know, you can always point on someone, but then, like, if people start with themselves, even impact investing world, there are so many people which are driven by profit still, so, and much fewer which really want to generate deep impact.
Absolutely.
So it's absolutely, we need, this is why actually I can reveal a little secret. What I also plan to do is impact yoga retreats, where we practice yoga first, getting to other mind, and then teaching people what is impact investing, then they will be much more ready to do also projects with higher impact.
We have a whole program we're rolling out across the world with the UN called Faith Long-Term Plans, and that's a whole audit of what faith own, and then they make commitments as to how they're shifting it, and a big part of that is assets. However, we have seven areas: assets, there's education and youth work, there's lifestyles, there's wisdom, and we are doing a webinar on wisdom, and working with a wonderful Buddhist teacher, follower of the Karmapa, one of the four heads of the big Tibetan Buddhist schools.
Mm-hmm.
And Kilo Chengyopa was the head of environment and religion projects for WWF USA. She, very much on your lines there, Svetlana, she almost had a complete meltdown and breakdown because of the strain of working for a multinational environmental group. It was really tough. She came out quite, you know, quite hurt and by it and exhausted. And her teacher, the Karmapa, taught her a technique for restoration, her body, mind, and spirit, if you like. She now teaches that to people in the environmental movement who burn out. Because the environmental movement burns out its staff and its supporters faster than any other movement in the world. And that's the group talking about sustainability. You know, we've got to get this balance. There's a wonderful teaching. Almost all the faiths have these four relationships. And I'll put it in sort of Christian, Jewish, Muslim terms, but it can be applied to anything. Four relationships. The first one is the relationship with the divine. Whatever you understand the divine to be, a relationship with the divine, so that you know you're part of the greater story. The second one is the relationship with your neighbors, and your neighbors in the Jewish Christian sense of the world, your relationship with other people. The third one is your relationship with the rest of life on earth. Mm-hmm. Where do you fit within the greater story of the whole of this beautiful planet and its generosity? Where do you fit into that? Mm-hmm. But the final one, mm-hmm. and this is the one that most activists forget, is your relationship with yourself. Mm-hmm. Because you do not have a sense of who you are. You do not have a still, small, quiet voice at the center. You are going to be no use to your neighbor, to the divine, or to the planet.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a wonderful thing, Rana. I'll sign up.
All right. Great. And then I would be delighted if you could also give a little preach to the audience at such impact yoga retreat.
All right.
Because yoga is not religious, you know, all of the religions are welcome. So it's doesn't matter. Everyone is talking about the same at the end in religions. So.
To some degree, I think we need to be careful, though. We have very much a strict policy that we are not interested in what unites the faiths. The reason people belong to a faith or a culture or a tradition is because it gives them something distinctive. Yeah. And what we're interested in is celebrating the wonderful diversity of ideas, of beliefs, of cultures, of languages, of ways of living that exist in the world. We are not interested in making them all the same. And the reasons why faiths do things are radically different. Some faiths believe we're here to be stewards or managers of the planet, or khalifa, as it's called in Islam. Yeah. Others believe we're just simply in this non-ending cycle of reincarnation within which we have a karmic responsibility.
Samsara, right?
Sure. Yes, exactly. So I think we've got to be recognizing that if you ask everybody to just say it's all really the same, then nobody has anything to bring.
I was a bit not cautious in this expression, I think, you know, but it's like what I see, that everyone in the world can pick the religion and come like this to the divine, you know, and as we are all different, it corresponds to different person, different religious corresponds, and then different paths are emerging at the end. So it's
I'm with you there, Svetlana, but I think there is a problem, and the environmental movement, the UN, they all treat religions as though, in fact, there was one occasion. So I was at the inaugural event that we did with the World Bank back in 1995, bringing the faiths to engage with the World Bank to raise alternative models of economics. Because remember, until about 250 years ago, every single culture in the world was run by religious values. Period. They may have been completely betrayed, they may have been completely destroyed, they may have been distorted, but the fundamentals were religious values. And the rise of secularism and nationalism as alternative rationales for why you do things is relatively recent and will probably be a somewhat passing phase in human history. But so when we brought these faiths together with the World Bank, we had a reception. And at the reception, a man from the IMF came up to me and shook me vigorously by the hand. He said, "Mr. Palmer, so wanted to meet you," he said, "because I'm so delighted that you're going to make all the religions the same." And before I could say anything, he said, "because statistically, they're a nightmare at the moment. So the sooner they all agree to everything, the easier it will be to manipulate them." And I just thought, yep, that's precisely why we're not going to do that.
Martin, I again go back to one more bit serious topic, is the indigenous. So the indigenous people, they have been in the forefront of protecting the nature, the environment, and the way they live the life, the way they are doing everything. And they are also now one of the, or maybe the most, who are suffering the maximum.
Yeah.
Do you, because you, when you're talking about faith invest, you're talking about the global religions, but these indigenous people generally do not have, are not part of this global religion. Are you also somehow taking them in consideration? Because whether you look at Amazon, whether you look in Indonesia, they are the ones suffering.
You're absolutely right. We do indeed. I mean, you're quite right. Faith Invest itself can only work with as major investing partners with groups that have clear sets of teachings, clear sets of sacred texts, clear sort of history of chronicling what they're for and what they're against and so forth. And that is not a feature of indigenous traditions on the whole. One has to also acknowledge that the vast majority of indigenous peoples are also members of either Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, or Islam. But they have always made it into something indigenous. One thinks of, particularly in the Amazon, of the extraordinary fusion between Catholic saints and Yoruba deities from West Africa and indigenous spirits in the forest. So you have a wonderful sort of melange of cultural influences. But as I cited earlier, if you want to protect the forest, the great forests, you work with the local And on the whole, not always, because of course you have communities that have been Hindu or Buddhist for 2,000 years, Christian for 1,000 years, Muslim for 500 years. But on the whole, those are indigenous peoples who have a relationship with that land. They do not have a relationship with other people's land to the same extent. It is a very local intense, and that's why they are so important. In our investment packages, we are looking to see where we can support sustainable livelihoods for those people, because the great danger of outsiders viewing indigenous as kind of wonderfully to be protected is that we fossilize them. And if you fossilize a community, they die.
Mm-hmm.
They die because no community remains the same. They are constantly evolving. So what we're looking at is how, with indigenous leaders and communities, with networks like the Interfaith Rainforest Initiative and many others that we're in touch with, how can we help those communities have control over their own income, not be dependent on grants from well-meaning Westerners? How can they show how you can live off and with a forest and give them a future which will enable those of the community that wish to go to university, wish to become engineers in California, wish to become teachers in Burundi, can do so, because you can't just keep them there like a zoo, like a sort of fossilizing process. There must be an element of a living tradition. And so we are looking, and we're working very closely with all sorts of groups as to how do you do that so that those communities can be there, can afford to be there, can earn an income that makes it possible for them to live well, have lifespans that are longer than is normal for those communities. And I come back also to something we brought together a few years ago, the major forest-owning faiths in the world, to look at adopting FSC, Forest Stewardship Council, criteria for the management of their forests. And we had at that groups that were Hindu and Buddhist and Shinto in particular. And we had the major Abrahamic faiths, not so much Judaism, but certainly Christianity and Islam. And at one point there came up a proposal from one of the Catholic organizations to say, look, why don't we say that any of the forests around our sacred places, any of the forests that we own that are commercial, that these are faith protected forests. And all the Abrahamic folk were like, oh, great idea, wonderful. Literally, the Shinto kind of went, and we said, what? And they said, but that's ridiculous. We said, what do you mean it's ridiculous? They said, we don't protect the forests, they protect us.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're trying to find in our investment programs around indigenous communities and particularly forests, but also, you know, water sources, the whole thing, is how do we not end up subverting a notion that the forest protects us by claiming that we protect
the forest? I wanted to take a couple of questions from the audience. One of them is saying, what is the common ground between the religions around the world?
Common ground is that they have been ignored, ridiculed, despised, had taken, had hundreds of millions of their followers slaughtered, murdered, put in concentration camps, denied their rights. They have been told they are old-fashioned, superstitious, non-scientific for the last 250 years. And their common cause is, please take us seriously. We know more about human nature. We know more about how to rebuild societies. We are stakeholders in the planet. Stop pretending we don't exist. Why, for example, are the Catholic Church and the major Muslim organizations not invited to the G20? They each run more schools than any single country that attends G20. Why aren't they there? Why is the British government, in its financing for climate change, not talking to the faith investors? Why are we being sidelined when actually, without us, civil society would fall apart?
Yep.
That's the common cause. We want to contribute. Invite us to the table. We'll come individually. We'll sit side by side. We'll help you.
And maybe then the other question from the audience, how can we create awareness about faith invests and religious funds? So how can we change this situation besides just inviting you, but anything else, what can be done?
First of all, you can make sure that I actually know how to get onto the website and get into your program, which I now have. But please, put up the information. Do put up our website. Do be in touch with us. You know, we have a whole rolling program of webinars exploring how faiths invest, the kind of values they have, looking at the assets, looking at buildings, looking at their medical work. You know, there is an enormous amount of resources out there for groups to look at. But in the end, many of you out there will be members of a faith.
Right.
There are two things you can do. The first one is ask of your faith what they are doing with their assets. And secondly, ask yourself, how faith consistent are you in where you put your skills, your knowledge, and your energy? Answer those two questions and then come to us and we'll see what we can do to help you get your faith be more faith consistent and maybe help you to be more consistent as well. That would be an adventure for us all to go on.
Thank you so very much, Martin. This was a complete pleasure. It was
Thank you. Yes, it's definitely too short. We have so many questions from the audience, from our part as well. So we need part two with Martin Palmer. Quite soon, it would be amazing.
and it will have to be every, we have to have 1 week and then 3 weeks gap.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. And Svetlana, it's been a delight to meet you. It really has. I mean, I know Ben, and that's that. There's no
but
delight.
We met. How could you forget? We met, Martin. I even have a picture with you. I will send it to you after.
Oh my God, at that dinner.
Yes, it's here. Yes.
Svetlana, mea culpa, mea culpa.
Hey, Martin, you have been taking Svetlana out for dinner. And I didn't. I wasn't even aware of it.
Oh, Svetlana, we've blown our cover. We've blown our cover. What can I say?
Now you come 3 times to our show, you know, one more time. Okay.
I would love to do so. It's been a real joy. Thank you both very much indeed. And
thank you a lot.
Let's see where we go. God bless.
Thank you.
Bye. All the very best. Bye.
Bye. Bye bye.
So, Svetlana, you go ahead or I go ahead?
whatever you want. If you, I've been quite talkative today. Maybe you go ahead.
No wonder. No, I just wanted to mention that next week, we are starting, it will be the first time that we will have more than one guest. And it was the ambassador, the Swiss ambassador from Nepal, Ambassador von Kepler, Mr. Bhattarai, also, and he's also from the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, and Tim Gocher, who is the CEO of the Dolma Impact Fund, which is the international private equity fund in Nepal since 2014. And we will talk about how impact investment is developing in Nepal. So see you next week on Friday.
Yes, see you next week. Act and with impact and with
today
faith.
We learned more. Yes, we learned more with faith.
Bye, everyone. Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.